And now, The Federal Drive with Tom Temin, sponsored by GEHA.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on this Wednesday, April 24th, 2024, 7 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Temin. Our producers are Eric White and Peter Masurlian. Our digital editors, Daisy Thornton, Michelle Sandiford, and Darris Lauderdale. Coming up in this hour of The Federal Drive, new insight into a health threat to U.S. troops stationed pretty much everywhere. Plus, the Defense Department gets serious about technology transfer to the troops. Those stories and much more ahead during this hour of The Federal Drive. But first, the Air Force will spend its own money to fix up privately owned housing projects at two bases. Members of Congress, though, aren't exactly sold on the idea, even though decrepit housing has been an ongoing issue for the Air Force. Federal News Network's Anastasia Obis joins me with the latest details. Anastasia, why is the Air Force covering the cost of reinvestment, as they put it, into private housing and not the owners?
In 2025, the Air Force is requesting about $144 million for privatized family housing. Of course, the first question from lawmakers during last week's hearing was, why is the Air Force covering that bill and not the private companies themselves, given that they assumed the responsibility of those units? Ravi Chaudhry, he is the boss of Air Force Installations, says the oversight program the Air Force put in place to hold private companies accountable is bringing some positive results. He says the service is directly involved with the structures. They're not just giving away money. They're not giving a lump sum and just saying, do what you wish, but they have a lot of oversight over it. That way, he says, they will be able to tell if the improvements that they're investing in have direct impacts on military families. They do that both with the installation command and resident advocates they hired to be the voices of those families. Let's take a listen to Dr. Chaudhry on how he thinks about additional investments into privatized family housing.
I will say one thing. When we need to act on behalf of our military members and their quality of life, we will. So when that occurs on these restructures, we make sure that it goes directly to those housing units, and our oversight programs provide that visibility to include our resident advisors, our resident advocates, who we've hired roughly 218 or so. We're going to continue that trend to make sure that that oversight maintains a level of awareness that allows us to hold these project owners accountable.
And how is the Air Force actually planning to make sure those companies are accountable for the overall quality of the housing?
This year, the service held a project owner at one of the Air Force installations accountable for about $58 million. That's to address mold issues in almost 1,000 units. Last year, the service held another project owner accountable for almost $32 million. And then another additional $33 million in 2024 to address some safety issues. Dr. Chaudhry mentioned in that clip that they hired over 200 what they call resident advisors to help service members resolve any housing issues along with their chain of command. But here's Ravi Chaudhry on what the Air Force is doing to hold those companies accountable.
What we've done is laid in an oversight program that we believe is getting us gains these days. We had a number of restructures last year. That number has gone down this year, and we expect that trend to continue. That's by providing significant oversight with accountability, oversight, and when we need to, enforcement.
Well, you have to have standards, and metrics to know what it is you're holding the housing owners accountable for, like zero mold or no broken windows. I don't know, there's probably 100 different metrics on a given apartment unit. So what are the metrics the Air Force is actually using here to make sure that they know what to oversee and can hold people to the fire?
Something that they put in place is if a contractor is not performing well, they put that contractor on a watch list. And being on a watch list, it puts the focus of the headquarters and the installation on that particular project manager. Then they get a notice on what it is that they need to improve upon. The biggest indicator is usually the feedback from the residents. Those on the watch list are enrolled in a program, and that's supposed to improve their performance. It gets at their performance incentive fee. So if they don't perform well, they get hit with penalties. Let's take a listen to Ravi Chaudhry again on how they evaluate how well contractors are performing.
Ultimately, if they fail in all three levels, we'll go back and go to a default situation. So that progressive approach, we believe, has been yielding some good impacts, especially with our newer project owners that are realizing that all they have to do is meet a certain standard and they'll get A grades. So some of the folks who have been around since 2005, they're slow to come along, but they're now starting to come along recognizing those gains.
Yeah, it's kind of a tough situation, Anastasia, because the housing operator owns the housing. It's not as if you can go somewhere else. Your reporting is showing the Air Force is requesting more funding relatively for privatized housing than the other armed services. Why is that?
Yes, the Air Force currently has an outsized number of problems in comparison to other services. Dr. Chaudhry said they will look into what it is that other services are doing that's successful. But we have been hearing about issues with privatized military housing since 2018. It sounds currently like there actually has been a shift from privatized housing is just the worst thing that can happen to let's actually introduce a lot more privatized housing. Let's privatize barracks. And that's partially due to financial constraints. But the way lawmakers talk about solving the housing issue, the winds have definitely shifted towards a more positive outlook on privatized housing. The Air Force, for example, this year, they're investing over $1 billion into modernizing its barracks. Their first privatization project for barracks is going to take place in California this year, and other services are following the same model. So, I mean, the winds are definitely shifting.
Federal News Network's Anastasia Obis, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Be sure to check out her story at federalnewsnetwork.com. Still to come, the Defense Department gets serious about technology transfer to the troops. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. A new group within the DOD seeks to track how well technology makes its way to troops. Heidi Shu, the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering, says it will use advanced data analytics to do so. The group is called Transition Tracking Action Group, or TTAG. Joining me with the details, the DOD's Chief Data Officer for Research and Engineering, Cyrus Jabari. Mr. Jabari, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Well, first of all, tell us, TTAG, what is this all about and what problem is it trying to solve?
The Transition Tracking Action Group, or the TTAG, is all about enhancing the department's visibility on its investments using data analytics, breaking data silos and unifying them together in novel ways so that we could have better insight over what we are doing, what we have invested in, and therefore oversight.
And when you say invested in, you mean what exactly? What areas of investment do you look at?
A number of different types of technology investments. So the department prioritizes 14 critical technology areas. That's been a key focus for us to get a better handle of how are we roadmapping for those 14 critical technology areas and what are things that are in the pipeline that we are developing or that we could take from the commercial sector. What the Transition Tracking Action Group cares about, though, is the whole wealth of technology investments from research and engineering to acquisition that exist along that life cycle that we could better observe, better get a hold of, and better bring to the warfighter or to the field.
What are some of those critical technologies? You mean like directed energy, artificial intelligence?
Yes, that's exactly right. Of the 14 critical technology areas, Heidi Shu's vision for technology competition says that there are these quote-unquote seed areas of emerging technology. Think biotechnology, quantum, and so forth. Then there are these more commercially adopted technology areas that we prioritize, such as trusted artificial intelligence and autonomy, or advanced computing and software. And then there are more defense-specific critical technology areas like hypersonics, directed energy, the ones you alluded to. So those are the critical technology areas that we prioritize, but we don't just want to get greater fidelity on the critical technology areas. There are other technology areas that the department prioritizes. Think in the Navy, for example, naval power or maritime systems. In the Army, soldier mobility or lethality. And then obviously with the announcement of the Replicator Initiative, we have niche combinations of technologies, such as what Deputy Secretary of Defense Kathleen Hicks announced. The focus for Replicator in this first tranche will be on what are called all-domain autonomous attritable or ADA2 technologies. We want to get a better grapple of across research, engineering, and acquisitions, and throughout the defense innovation ecosystem, what is in the pipeline and how can we better leverage it?
Right. So what is the impediment to understanding the total picture now?
I think within any large organization, as you would see across industries, we are discovering that there is a huge need to get data outside of the data silos that they exist in. There's been a significant move within the Department of Defense to be responsive to Congress to make sure that we could at least get a greater hold of our financial data. And we've made significant strides since at least 2018 when the department established its first universe of transactions through the Advancing Analytics, otherwise known as ADVANA, Enterprise Data Analytics Platform, where we unified all of the different general ledger accounting systems across DoD and had them talk to each other so we could create a common financial operating picture with great fidelity and near real-time visibility. And so since that innovation within DoD, there's been a lot of work from the battlefield to the boardroom to break data silos. The TTAG is trying to focus on something that is of common interest, not only within the department's research and engineering and acquisition and requirements communities, but also to Congress and the common taxpayer when they want to make sure that we could answer questions on what is in the Valley of Death or what made it across the Valley of Death and how efficient are we being in tracking those things across or within those valleys.
We're speaking with Cyrus Jabari. He's the Chief Data Officer for Research and Engineering at the Defense Department. And I guess this is also a way that you can avoid duplication of investments or, you know, one company getting money for the same thing from two different far-flung pieces of DoD. Not that that could ever happen.
Well, I think that with any greater insights, very wise senior leader actually coined the term, at least to me for the first time, that with greater insight, you can provide greater oversight. These are things that our leadership says should have been or could have been perhaps prioritized to answer these age-old questions that it sounds like TTAG is trying to address right now. Tracking technology transitions, as you know, is not something that has just sprung up in the year 2024. That interest has existed for decades. So we want to, using the novel innovations in tools, in policy and process changes that have been taking place in the past few years, want to capitalize on that, break data silos so that we could provide greater insight and therefore support better oversight.
Right. So besides oversight and accountability, which you have to have, though, is there an element of making sure that, golly, this technology has so much promise, why isn't it productized quicker? Why isn't it turning into an acquisition and getting it into the troops' hands, so to speak, which is the ultimate goal of all of this?
That's exactly right. So it's setting us up to get better insights into the investments we make and the products that make it to the warfighter or have not yet made it to the warfighter or could make it to the warfighter based on the requirements that we understand, those requirements generated by the end users, the warfighters, the combatant commands, etc. It's also laying the groundwork, though, for us to understand and capitalize on our impact in economic security and economic growth. Through TTAG, we'll get greater insights into the investments that we have made that ended up into the commercial sector, that ended up being productized, and see our contributions to the commercial sector and private capital spaces. But better yet, it will be incredible to see insights such as those things that we initially invested in and were productized that we ended up buying on the back end and delivering to the warfighter. I'm very excited to see more information from those outputs.
And how does TTAG itself work? I mean, is there a room somewhere in the Pentagon that has a name TTAG on it now? And who comprises TTAG? and who do you matrix with to get the information in and back out?
So TTAG, although formally established this past month, has actually been in the works in an informal capacity for about 2 years. Really, the background for what generated this was in May of 2021, Deputy Secretary of Defense Kathleen Hicks announced the launch of an innovation steering group. And the innovation steering group, or ISG, one of its main lines of efforts was to map this defense innovation ecosystem that everybody talks about, that you see being mapped in, I think, academic and commercial spaces. We wanted to get a greater handle of, when we say the word innovation, what do we mean, and who is actually executing work in support of that. In relation to the mapping of the defense innovation ecosystem, which I was very happy to support when it was first announced, we also noticed that everybody talks about technology transition, but we have different definitions for what transition means, or what a technology even means. So I was thrilled to support the first ever standardized definition of technology transitions and technology transition pathways that was codified in a joint memorandum from Honorable Heidi Shu, our Chief Technology Officer, in conjunction with the Undersecretary for Acquisition and Sustainment, Honorable Bill LaPlante, and then Undersecretary for Policy, Colin Call. That memorandum was issued in April 2022, and as a data nerd, that helped me have a common lexicon where we could then start to search for and tag technology transitions. In the past year and a half since, we've been building out advanced analytics prototypes or pilots, where within seconds, for example, for the first time ever, we can actually track the number of new entrants into the defense innovation ecosystem through research, development, test, and evaluation dollars, and see that within the past 3 years, it's actually increased by 62%. Or we can track small business innovation research, small business technology transfer transitions, which get a lot of commentary externally within seconds, again, through these prototypes. In addition to prototyping out solutions through unique data connections that we've built and demonstrated back to what was the innovation steering group and community of interest within the department trying to attack this problem, we also created the informal transition tracking action group, which was tasked to develop an initial set of recommendations in an implementation plan that would get the most senior leader sign-off, from the Deputy Secretary of Defense to the Secretary of Army, Navy, Air Force, the undersecretary leaders within the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and the chairman or vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, on what is the first attack we could make in breaking data silos, unifying data, and for the first time ever, getting a tranche of data that tracks technology transitions as described earlier. That implementation plan is actually finalized. We are in our final moments of receiving approval, hopefully, and I look forward to keeping you updated on what we decide to do. But yes, TTAG is going to continue to prototype data analytics solutions and consider policy and process recommendations that need to address key data sets.
And by the way, that definition of transition, does that encompass the idea of not transitioning from research to a prototype, but transitioning into something, again, in a warfighter's arsenal or tool set that's actually deployable and useful for the mission?
Yes, we want to emphasize the importance of tracking things that make it to the field to demonstrate our return on investment. Absolutely.
So if you haven't crossed the valley of death with it, then it hasn't transitioned really.
Well, I think in a more meta sense, as described by, say, the Office of Strategic Capital, for example, there is not just one valley of death, but there are different valleys of death or stages that a idea needs to cross, from lab to prototype, from prototype to product, and product to scale. And so you could think of something being in the field as that scale moment, that end state. We want to track across those valleys, within the valleys, but also across those different iterative steps, because that helps us then connect a technology solution, ideally, and its owner or its performer within the department to the next stage that could Sherpa it across the valleys.
And your job as chief data officer then is to help people choose the right data that has to be combined to get the answer they want from different systems throughout DoD.
Yes, this is one of the most exciting parts of the digital transformation journey that I've seen in DoD, because as we've developed those prototypes that I alluded to, we're seeing them being heavily integrated within common business processes that did not exist before. And so hopefully when we get this massive shift in transitions data and analytics, we will be able to enable the technology officer, the chief technology officer, and the various technology officers, end users, acquirers across DoD, and even researchers to see what's in the wild and what's maybe missing.
Cyrus Jabari is the chief data officer for research and engineering at the Defense Department. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And we'll post this interview along with more information about TTAG at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, don't look now, but your thrift savings plan portfolio is swooning. But first, new insight into a health threat to U.S. troops stationed overseas. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. Lung tissue analysis has shown in detail some serious threats to the health of military service members. The U.S. Geological Survey partnered with researchers at National Jewish Health. They looked into airborne threats in various locations where service members work and live. And this revealed some unpleasant surprises. To find out more, Federal News Network's Eric White spoke to National Jewish Health pulmonologist Dr. Cecile Rose.
For the study that you're interested in, we took, I believe, 24 the biopsies from the 64 of previously deployed military people with lung disease, and we compared them to 11 lung tissue samples of people who were deceased and whose tissue was available to us in a tissue biobank. You know, for example, this is people who may have been involved in a motor vehicle crash and they donated their lung tissue for science. And so that was archived for our use. So we took 24 of the previous deployed biopsies and the 11 from the controls, the deceased controls, to see if there was any difference between the particle matter that was contained in the lungs, the inorganic dust, we call it, contained in the lungs of the previously deployed military personnel compared with controls. And we were fortunate because we had information on their ages, their smoking histories, their gender, those kinds of things that may also impact retained lung dust. So we had a really important opportunity to compare differences between people who had previously deployed to those who had not.
And you, I imagine, found some major differences.
We did. Working with scientists from the U.S. Geological Survey who have access to very, very sophisticated equipment and analytical techniques, we were able to look at these lung tissues and compare these two cohorts, the previously deployed to the controls. And what we found was that the people who had previously deployed had substantially and significantly higher proportions of silica dust and silicate dust in their lungs compared to the controls. And what was even more compelling about that is that the previously deployed cases for whom we had lung tissue samples were younger, so they had had less time to accumulate dust in their lungs than the controls. And they were also, percentage-wise, less likely to have smoked. That just happened to be the statistics for the control samples were, you know, the percentage was higher for smokers in the controls than the deployers. So again, you would expect that maybe that would make it more likely that our findings would be non-significant. You know, that the deplorers may have had more dust, but they were younger, less likely to smoke, and maybe it would all be a wash. So we were surprised at how significant the differences were in terms of the proportions of silica dust in the lung tissue samples from the deplorers compared to the controls.
Yeah, is the oversimple takeaway from this study that this is more of a chronic respiratory disease, is more of a prevalent problem with those who have been deployed more recently than you know, just the people who were stationed next to a burn pit or something like that?
If I understand your question, I would tell you that I think, you know, what our findings show is that if people have previously deployed to areas like Iraq and Afghanistan, they're proportions of retained lung dust containing silica and silicates is significantly higher. And, you know, in terms of there being a clear ability for us to relate that to burn pits or diesel exhaust or combat dust or some of the things that I mentioned at the beginning, it's hard for us to do that. I think there is a suggestion, however, that people who go to these very arid, very dusty environments are much more likely to retain silica dust in their lungs than if they hadn't gone to those deployment areas.
Got it. And so, you know, they're deploying to these places. They're not, it's not the moon. How is it that folks are able to live out in these areas, even though they're very remote and very dusty, and you introduce new people to the environment and all of a sudden their lungs are infected? Is it just the old trope of, you know, don't drink the local water unless you're used to it kind of thing?
Yeah, you know, that's a really important question, and it comes up a lot. And that is, if this exposure is important to our military men and women and places them at risk, what about the people who live there all the time? And the answer there is, we don't know, simply put. I would guess that those people probably are at risk for lung disease from exposure to particulate matter in the same way that our military men and women are, but they may have other more acute and serious challenges than chronic lung disease from having lived in those areas where, you know, really access to, you know, social services and infrastructure may not be nearly what we're used to. I would guess there's probably a lot of lung disease within those populations, but they have not been studied, and it really would be inferential, not based on any true scientific evidence that I have.
Understood. Okay. And so there's probably no real good answer to this, but is there anything that can be done other than limiting exposure? You know, are there any tools in place that might be able to be utilized to try and put a stop to the amount or at least just lessen the blow of the chronic respiratory diseases that veterans are coming home with?
Well, we have certainly given that a lot of thought. And I would tell you that I think there probably are some administrative techniques that could be used to minimize exposures, especially during things like dust storms. But that said, I am by no means, you know, a person who knows how to tell the military how to limit exposures, especially when, you know, people are in, you know, deployed to areas of combat where there are many, many risks. But that said, I think it's important that people who return with respiratory symptoms are taken seriously, that they are not dismissed if they have a simple breathing test that's normal or a chest x-ray that doesn't show much. This requires a different level of diagnostic intensity and evaluation. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think that it is important for us to understand what the relevant exposures are. And there were some limitations to our study. So, you know, because we are looking at lung tissue, we can't say very much about other kinds of exposures that people may have had, for example, to paint fumes or to allergens or to other organic chemicals or pesticides, because we can't measure those in the lung tissue samples. We just, you know, that the technology does not allow us to do that. And so we can say that there were high levels of silica in the lung tissue samples, but we can't say that that's the only problem. So that's really an important point, I think, for me to make is I would suspect that there probably are other relevant exposures that were just not measurable using the techniques, the analytical tools and equipment that we had. But I think that the military realizes and that the VA also realizes that people are returning with respiratory injury and that they need to be monitored over time to make sure that we're taking good care of them, to see whether these folks develop any unexpected or long latency diseases. Those are diseases, respiratory diseases that may take time to show up. And it's also important, I think, for military people and doctors to realize that there is this 2022 PACT Act. And the PACT Act is a congressionally mandated act that understands or presumes that if people have certain respiratory disease diagnoses, that those are related to deployment exposures and that those service members need to receive benefits. So that's another important thing, I think, for us to just be aware of, that this is an important act. It recognizes that there is risk of respiratory injury and that we have to monitor people over time to make sure that we catch any other respiratory disease complications early on while there's still an opportunity to treat them.
Dr. Cecile Rose is a pulmonologist with National Jewish Health, speaking with Federal News Network's Eric White. You can find this interview along with a link to the service member study at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, don't look now, but your thrift savings plan portfolio is swooning. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. Stocks and bonds both have gyrated badly in recent weeks. It's not a fun time to be invested, and yet you sort of have to be. For an assessment of the recent few weeks, we turn to certified financial planner Art Stein of Arthur Stein Financial. All right, give us the review, Art. It's been a stomach-churning kind of gyroscope.
So the C and the S and the I funds, the first quarter of this year up through March 31st, they had done great. The C fund was up 10.5%, S was up 7%, and the I fund 6%. So that was a really good 3 months. But then through last Friday, the end of last week, all of a sudden things completely turned around. And during that 3 week period, all three of those stock funds were down considerably. C fund down 5%, S fund down 6.9%, I fund down 4%. So all of a sudden, year to date, C fund's still up, the S fund is down, I fund's pretty flat. So it just completely turned around. Now, the bond funds, again, during the first quarter, the F fund was down about 0.7%, but now year to date, it's down 3%. And the reason for this, in my opinion, is that the Federal Reserve has a very ambitious goal to reduce inflation in the United States to 2%. It looked like inflation was going down pretty much monthly. I'm not saying prices were going down, but the rate of inflation was decreasing each month. And as a result, people expected there would be about 3 interest rate reductions by the Fed during this year. Well, that decline in the inflation rate has stalled. And now commentators say, well, we may not get any interest rate reductions this year. And partly as a result of this, interest rates have increased. The 10-year bond, the interest rate went from 4.2% to 4.6%. That's a big change in the interest rate on the 10-year bonds. It's a very high rate. Of course, mortgage rates are over 7% again. And things just look very different in terms of the financial markets. Now, in terms of the economy continues to do extremely well. Employment is very strong. The economy's strong. We're not really seeing problems there. But of course, the stock market and the bond markets, they, you know, are affected by the economy, but they're affected by a lot of other things too.
Well, sure. So, if you have high interest rates, though, that can depress housing, although some parts of the country housing is going gangbusters, other parts of the country not so much. New housing starts, those affect the economy at some point because housing, like automobiles, are drivers of lots of other related commodity sales.
But, you know, the mortgage rate, the rate for new mortgages really has not changed that much. I mean, it's over 7% now. It's been over 7%, you know, was last year at various times. Went down maybe a little under 7%. We're not seeing big changes. And one thing that I would point out is that the inflation rate, which is the change from the previous year in prices, last month was 3.5%. You know, people are saying, well, that's so high. But actually, the average annual inflation rate in the United States since 1950 has been 3.5%. It's exactly the same rate. The inflation rate we have now is just average compared to the historical rate in the United States. And I don't know why the Fed wants to get it down to 2%, thinks it can get it down to 2%. We have had inflation that low, but that was so unusual. And with these huge budget deficits that we're running, huge budget deficits, and this big increase in the amount of money the federal government owes and has to finance every year, it makes it very hard to get inflation down.
Right. I think that might be a dawning factor in some of these markets. For example, the interest on the public debt by the federal government, that outlay now exceeds the defense budget. And so, and when you look at it in terms of the percentage of GDP that is represented by debt and all of these things, those numbers are beginning to become visibly and unassailably unsustainable. And you've got people in the government saying that as well.
So for individual investors, which is, you know, your listeners, I would say one thing I really would like to emphasize is that if you're worried about inflation, keep in mind that historically, stocks, which we mean the C and the S and the I fund, have historically been a very good hedge against inflation because they tend to go up in price along with inflation. Their sales tend to go up with inflation. Their dividends tend to go up with inflation. Now, bonds are not a good hedge against inflation. And both the G and the F fund, whether it's low inflation or high inflation, people should expect that after you take into account taxes and inflation, the rate of return on the bond funds is probably going to be negative, i.e., your purchasing power is going to go down, even though the value of the bond fund might go up. But it will not go up enough to compensate for taxes and inflation. So we're really back where we've been, well, forever. Past performance is no guarantee of future performance, but historically, stocks have considerably outperformed bonds over longer periods of time, and they've done it by enough to increase purchasing power after taking into account taxes and inflation.
In some funny sense, bonds are like money because they are based on loans, ultimately, whereas stocks are based on different types of securities. So it's kind of like the old rule, your money may go down in value, but if you can have your holdings rise in value with the degree your money's going down, like you've been describing, you're going to be in better shape.
Exactly. So, you know, if you wanted to look at the 15-year average rates of return, I mean, the C fund has averaged 14.5% per year for 15 years. The G fund only 2.4%. The F fund only 2.6%. That's a big difference.
Right. So whatever instrument you're in, you want to stay at least ahead of inflation to be able to tread water.
Yeah. I mean, if you're trying to finance your retirement with investments that are going to lose purchasing power over time, that makes it very difficult to do. And of course, FERS retirees, anytime inflation's over 2%, the adjustment in their FERS retirement is less than the full inflation rate. The purchasing power of their FERS annuity is going to go down over time. So if they're all in the F and G fund, then that purchasing power is going down over time. I mean, that's a problem.
All right. So then, like you say, the eternal advice is try to stay in the historically high growth funds and don't lose your nerve because they're gyrating now.
Exactly. I'm not saying don't have investments in the F&G fund. I think those are very worthwhile, but you need to have a solid percentage in the CS&I funds.
Art Stein is a certified financial planner of Arthur Stein Financial. As always, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. And this program note, be sure to sign up for day two of Federal News Network's Customer Experience Exchange starting at 1. Today's speakers include CX success stories from Veterans Affairs, the National Transportation Safety Board, AmeriCorps, and the Navy. The CX Exchange continues today at 1. Sign up at federalnewsnetwork.com. The IRS is telling Congress that billions of dollars in multi-year modernization funds are helping the agency improve customer service. Well, now it's asking lawmakers for even more funding. The agency just wrapped up another tax filing season, claiming that it met a high bar for customer service. Federal News Network's Jory Heckman joins me with the latest. How did they do this year? I got my refund pretty fast.
Me as well. But from the IRS's telling, they not only had more customers coming in for help, but they answered more of those questions. The IRS says it answered more phone calls from taxpayers, about a million more calls this filing season. And if you zoom out to 2022 levels, they actually answered 3 million more calls. They have set this bar for a couple of years now of 85% of calls being answered. That's the magic number by the IRS's telling. They had answered 88% of incoming calls. Again, this is kind of night and day compared to 2022 when it answered 15% of calls. At this point, the IRS has received more than 100 million individual tax returns and issued more than $200 billion in refunds.
And so far as we know, Jory, that anyone who called in 2022 that was still on hold, they have been answered.
That is also the idea. Yes.
All right, good.
And so we recently heard from IRS Commissioner Danny Werfel. He told the Senate Finance Committee at a recent hearing that the IRS is really looking a lot better these days because of this multi-year modernization fund that's been tapping into.
The Inflation Reduction Act funding has enabled the IRS to have one of its best filing seasons ever in terms of customer service. Taxpayers are seeing a difference.
So the money has been spent to good use, according to Danny Werfel. Why are they asking for even more than was promised in that Inflation Reduction Act?
Yeah, so this hearing was a combination look at 2025 and beyond. Just for next year alone, the IRS is actually asking for a flat budget of $12.3 billion, same as what they currently have. But the big ask they're making of Congress is topping up this Inflation Reduction Act fund, which is being drawn down from $60 billion. Well, what they're really asking here is that the Congress reverse a previous $20 billion cut to the IRA funds and actually stretch that funding out, top off those funds for a longer timeline than they originally bargained for, to 2 or so years beyond that. To do all the back of the envelope math here, Tom, they are asking for a total $104 billion of these kind of modernization funds that they've been using to hire more employees and get some long deferred IT modernization projects back on track. The IRS says that this is actually going to have a pretty good return on investment, and that if it does get this full $104 billion that it's asking for, the IRS expects it can recover an additional $341 billion that it wouldn't otherwise be able to do.
And that $341 billion is over 10 years, so $34.1 billion a year.
Correct.
So $104 billion total extra to get back $341 billion over 10 years.
A roughly $1 in $3 return on investment.
And what happens, do they say, if they don't get that extra money?
Werfel says that the IRS has been delivering a much better level of customer experience. They want to make sure that they can sustain that for a longer period of time. And he says that going back to that flat budget, that the IRS has had to periodically borrow from that multi-year modernization fund to kind of, as he says, keep the trains running on time, do the day-to-day stuff that is underfunded, keep the lights on, make sure employees are being paid. And he says that shortfall for annual appropriations is in the neighborhood of $2 to $3 billion, and that's what they're ultimately borrowing from the Inflation Reduction Act funds. The IRS just recently has hired 5,000 new employees specifically to answer those phones, specifically to improve that level of customer experience. And Werfel says that ultimately The IRS needs this top off of modernization funds to avoid funding cliffs and make sure that it can retain this workforce that's growing and keep these IT modernization projects on track.
It's not about asking for more and more and more money to build an ever-increasing IRS. It's about achieving a baseline, because what happens in the out years is all the money goes away. So if you look at 2026, we lose all of our ability to maintain services. If you look at 2028 and 2029, we lose all of our ability to maintain technology because there's a cliff. So that money that you're describing as of concern is really just intended to address the cliffs in the out years.
We don't want the IRS going over a cliff, and we know Danny Werfel does not. Meanwhile, they've had their direct file pilot project. How's that been going, Jory?
Well, for something brand new and for something in the realm of government technology, Werfel says it's been a really big success. A limited rollout that we saw in this past year. More than 100,000 taxpayers use this new direct file platform that looks and feels a lot like the TurboTaxes of the world, but it's run entirely by the IRS. So the IRS invited taxpayers in 12 states to test out the direct file pilot this filing season. And based on that feedback, the IRS is looking to see if it's worthwhile to expand that program in future years. But from Werfel's telling, this was a big success. They got help from GSA and the U.S. Digital Service and said that this is the kind of thing you'd expect to see roll out in the private sector.
It's gone very well. I think of it as a product launch. We're putting a new product on the street, if you will, and our customers, in this case taxpayers, are going to let us know if the product is working effectively and if they think they would like to use the product in the future.
Now, the members of Congress listening were skeptical about that money request, the plus up that he was seeking. What do they think about the direct file and its future?
We heard from the committee chairman, Ron Wyden. He did point out that 100,000 taxpayers out of a universe of 100 million plus taxpayers in the entire country is kind of a drop in the bucket. But from what he has heard from his own constituents, people like it. They really, you know, would like to see this roll out in a bigger way, and said, in so many words, bravo to the IRS for rolling out something that looks and feels good. You only need to look at the Education Department and the rollout of a new FAFSA tool to see cases where this still isn't rolling out the way it's supposed to. The ranking member of the committee, Mike Crapo, however, he said the program is wasteful and duplicative because there is still this free file alliance out there where the IRS partners with private tax preparation providers that for taxpayers below a certain income threshold, they can do this for free, and said, why are we reinventing the wheel here if that is already out there? So really colors in some of the skepticism that some of the committee members had about this project.
Bottom line, though, we do have a fairly significantly different IRS now than 3-4 years ago.
It definitely is the case that it's a lot different from where it was just a short period of time ago. And this is the kind of direction that they're looking to go in.
Federal News Network's Jory Heckman, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
And be sure to check out his story at federalnewsnetwork.com. This is The Federal Drive with Tom Temin. For the latest updates, stay with federalnewsnetwork.com or follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn. I'm Tom Temin.